CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
First, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association for Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors, whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And today we are joined by Richard Sims. Richard, good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for coming on and being part of the show. We are a finance show, and we're going to get into a relatively deep element of finance with you. You're an entrepreneur, and today you have a business in real estate. Before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your background and just career-wise, what are the major points of your career?
You know, I'm actually a registered professional geologist and earned a graduate degree in petroleum geology and worked in engineering consulting. And ended up being a regional and a national program manager. And during this progression of my career, I saw all the money that I was managing in the business and the staff and the happy clients and all this. I'm like, I want to own my own business rather than be an employee. So I was really driven to take my career to the next step. And I chose to do that through ownership of residential rental income property.
So let's jump right the way back. What was your first job, whether it was paying or not? What was your first job?
You know, my first job, I used to pick up little jobs around people's yards, cutting grass and raking leaves, you know, pretty much all through school.
And what did you learn from that? Not to do it again or something deeper than that?
You know, I learned to be paid by the job rather than the hour that I worked. I would negotiate a flat cost. And then proceed.
So speed and efficiency was something that you learned quite early on then?
That's correct. And it was further pressed in my mind when I worked one summer in a cotton mill doing manual labor.
Wow, that's got to be
and
tough.
It was a motivation to be a good student.
So, grass cutting and cotton fields and such, that's pretty manual intensive labor.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Were you out in the sunshine during that?
I was. And fair skin and all.
Sure. And so you went through, there's kind of an analogy there. You were outdoors and then you went on to geology. Mm-hmm. So how do you get from geology all the way through to real estate? I mean, it's not a lot of green and grass and such in concrete.
It's a circuitous route because with the science of geology, I ended up being a business manager in the consulting world. And so from the technical background that I learned in geology, I learned attention to detail and attention to finance. I learned financial skills and business management, profit and loss and overhead. And it all motivated me to work in a business where I could earn the profit that I was generating for my own employer.
Now, you skipped through about five or six things there pretty quickly that are very key to any business. Mm-hmm. Let me, if I can, jump back through them. You talked about some financials, the balance sheet, the profit and loss, cash flow. Mm-hmm. Is there any element there that is one element that you use as a core driver for your business today? Is it the P&L? Is it the balance sheet, being afraid of what's coming there on the aftermath, the next couple of months, the next year, you know, the reserves that's going to whack you in the rear end? Mm-hmm. Or is it the cash flow? What is it that drives you on that?
That's a very good question. I always value real estate based upon the income they can generate rather than a speculative investment hoping for future appreciation. And so I own real estate as a business that's driven by income. It's driven off the cash flow and the opportunity for profit.
So that recurring revenue stream.
It is the recurring revenue stream, and I marry that with talent and the staff that I have working for me. And having personnel that I learned from the consulting world who are motivated by their employment and are motivated to do a good job and take ownership for their own responsibilities. So by having a well-motivated, hard-working, loyal staff like a family together with a business that can generate strong income has been a role model for success. both in the consulting career and in real estate.
Well, let's look a little bit about that consulting career. You were giving advice to your clients, and this was a little bit early on in your career. What we tend to find, what I tend to find, I'm in the consulting world and have done so for, you know, on and off during my career. In the early stages, as a consultant, it's learning those skill sets as to how to manage. Essentially, you're in a customer service role. You're in a client-facing relationship. Are there any elements that stand out to you in terms of lessons learned from that client-facing element? Any mistakes? I mean, we all judge ourselves based on our failures, and failures themselves aren't a bad thing. You just want to learn and not repeat the mistake, right? Are there any key points there or any failures that you had that give you a life lesson learned?
That's a very good point. And I've always felt in my consulting career that I had a dual role because I had to manage the business and profitability of my employer together while serving the best interests of my client. And really, we always put with my staff, and we always put our clients' interests first ahead of our own. And then we're rewarded with continued work and a loyal client because we serve their best interests. And I often
it's a three-way relationship. It's a triangle, isn't it?
It is.
The company that is essentially paying you, for all better terms, the consulting agency or the staffing agency, and then the client. And the client is key.
And the client is key. And I ended up being in a position where I was helping my clients manage their own reserves for future repairs and replacement from the engineering type of work that we were doing. And it can be threatening for a consultant to come into a client's book of business and close projects. But it's in the client's best interest at times to complete a project and be through with it.
Sure.
And so you have this wrestling within the consulting business between the desire to make a large sale and the desire to serve the interests of your client. And I always saw in the business world that those talented individuals who could sell a product at an above-market rate may do well in the short term, but their career would be shortchanged because the reality always catches up.
You know, you're absolutely right. There is that, I won't call it a conflict. I think that's too strong a term. And that might potentially bring in something that would be along maybe ethical boundaries. But there's always that struggle in terms of you are client-facing, so you are the one that can potentially influence the client to say, hey, you know, Richard, can you do X for me? Can you do Y for me? But in the same regard, helping a client understand what is going wrong in their business is why you're there. And for some clients, putting it right, for some consultants, sorry, putting it right is also part of the program. Were you the kind of consultant that identified the problems and went to implement the solution?
That's correct. And when we identified the problems, we identified multiple solutions too. And you are correct. Sometimes the best solution was the most expensive solution because it may clean up a long-term liability for the client.
You know, that's often a struggle. When certainly in the finance field, when individuals go into the consulting ranks, I give it between about a 1 and a 3 month time period when you take a CFO or a controller or a vice president that has been typically managing the accounting or the finance function, and then you put them in a consulting capacity. There's a couple of months whereby they are in the consulting ranks, and then there typically is a major area where they're making a major recommendation. And to your point, there may be options 1, 2, and 3, each with different associated risks, each with different time frames of implementation and thereby cost. And invariably, the consultant will come back to me and they'll say, the client won't take my recommendation. And you might be recommending option 1, and they are choosing option 2 or 3 for various factors that you may or may not know, for various elements, perhaps of politics, perhaps of cost. And that is often the first challenge that I see with somebody that has gone from the traditional employment path, being the one managing the function and making the decisions, to being the consultant where you are purely in an advisory capacity and you aren't the decision maker. That is the crux of, okay, for them, now I'm a consultant. And for the team member managing them, that's when the liaison of trying to help them through balancing those options and those risks. Is that something that you've continued through? Now you manage your own business. Did that give you the forefront of looking at things in a risk-based environment?
It gave me a lot of experience. And the second challenge that goes along with what we just discussed, once the option's selected, then as a manager, the consultant has to execute the plan. And the plan often can be multiple years with various budgets per year and managing personnel, as well as managing the own capacity utilization of our internal staff. So there's a lot of balls in the air, but I always found that very challenging and exciting. And in reality, I never knew what was going to happen when the phone rang.
In today's business, you're managing actual properties. Do you also consult to companies at the same time?
I actually manage my own portfolio property, and okay. I have some partners on a couple of the deals.
Okay.
And it's I follow the same practices I use in the engineering consulting world. I manage the property for the long-term best interest of the physical asset, as well as to maximize the collection of rent. And I actually take care of our clients, our residents.
Is it residential property that you do, or is it commercial?
It is residential, residential rental property. I call them commercial. They're apartment complexes. So
I see.
Some multifamily residential housing for blue-collar working-class communities in North Atlanta and Central Georgia.
So in that regard, for you, is the quote-unquote customer, is that the apartment complex, I don't know the term, company or agency, or is it the end user, i.e. the person living in the apartment?
I think of it twofold. It is the actual family, the individual living in the residence, as well as the physical asset that we manage. And for instance, we have our roofs are in great condition, our capital property is well maintained. And we maintain on-site management, on-site maintenance staff, and serve our clients day-to-day, both in maintaining a physical good condition that's free of pests, as well as maintaining a quiet residential community, which is a lot of work to maintain a good client base and prevent people from violating leases or prevent the occurrence of crime from, to take a new residence. For instance, we will run a credit and criminal background search, and we don't allow drug dealing or other type of activity that's undesirable for a residential community. But it does place work on our managers to identify such and deal with it when it is observed.
So you manage it internally, and there are companies out there who have real estate, and they don't do the management of the portfolio.
No, I'm a very hands-on manager.
Interesting. So from a finance perspective, what is the element that will cause you to be attracted to an apartment? We're still in the depths of recession as it relates to real estate. Are there still good deals out there?
There are. In fact, this is probably a generational opportunity for someone to create wealth through the purchase and renovation and management of a commercial property right now, because it is a buyer's market today, with the recession that we've had in real estate. And so I'm attracted to the creation of value and the ability to solve a problem. And it's very feasible to come into a property that's had long-term stable ownership that is distressed because of neglect in both management and capital expenditures. So it provides an opportunity for a buyer to come in on a distressed income statement and make a very attractive purchase.
Both in capital asset realization as well as monthly and annual ongoing income generation.
That's correct. And improve the property management, improve the physical condition of the asset, as well as bring in good on-site maintenance and management, fill up below-market vacancies, and raise rents. And it's when you raise the income statement of a property, it's very feasible to see a 50 or 100% appreciation in the asset, just simply through improved management and attention to detail with maintenance.
Are there a lot of properties out there that have been put into disrepair?
That's correct. You often see a property, unfortunately, if the owner is financially distressed, or perhaps the owner has had the property for a duration period beyond their own interest to manage it, where you see properties are neglected, and they can go into what I call a downward spiral because the tenants, if you degrade the quality of the tenants living in your community, the better tenants will leave.
Yeah, sure. That's a quick path outwards, isn't it?
It's a very quick path outwards.
So let's talk a little bit about what today is happening in real estate. It's been out there for quite some time. There is a term, REIT, for the Real Estate Income Trust. Mm-hmm. Explain to the listeners what that is.
We actually are not a publicly traded REIT.
Okay.
And so we actually own property through partnership.
I see.
Through partnership, the members actually derive benefit from direct ownership of the asset. And that direct ownership of the asset also provides a tax shelter to the income because the apartment community can actually depreciate the purchase price of the asset over a period of years against earned income from the partners.
So essentially you set up a corporation to house the assets, i.e. the properties,
mm-hmm.
And the properties are acquired. Your investors are all private, so mm-hmm. I understand that it would be beyond the friends and family, mm-hmm. but it is that private individual mm-hmm. investor. It's not one of the larger investors, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just too conservative. I have a financial planner and a brokerage account, but I'm too conservative of an investor to trust my financial future to the vagaries of a daily auction market through the Wall Street Stock Market Exchange. And I joke with my friends that one cannot sleep under a stock certificate and I own the roof. And there's been a certain value to owning a physical asset versus a minority interest in a publicly traded corporation. Because with the physical asset, I can control the business, you know, direct the daily activities. And if I wanted to sell some of my Exxon stock, anyone can open up the newspaper and see the public price. And with the real estate, it is also an auction market, except there can be limited buyers. And so I'm not competing in my world with hedge funds and with publicly traded companies for the purchase of the assets, thereby giving me a great opportunity to discover unknown value.
So how do you choose your partners and investors?
That's a very good question. It's business networking from my historical consulting career and from networking within the Atlanta Apartment Association.
I see. And do you have a particular profile for that investor? And the reason that I ask that question is very often the company that is looking to raise mm-hmm. funds, which mm-hmm. essentially you going out and obtaining mm-hmm. an investor is mm-hmm. raising funds. You have typically a profile of the ideal kind of investor. Normally we find that investors want and need to know about the product that mm-hmm. the company is selling. Mm-hmm. For you, it is a service in that you're providing housing, temporary housing. So does your investor, would he or she come from that industry?
The investor is typically someone who's accredited and has significant assets, and they're looking for diversification and direct ownership of a passive rental income property. And it's the investor, someone looking for an 8 to 10% annualized return on their investment in terms of tax-advantaged rental income directly from the property, as well as long-term capital appreciation of their original investment.
So our
investors tend to be other business owners, other real estate owners, people.
Is it a tight-knit community?
It is a tight-knit community. The world is funny, even in a metropolitan area like Atlanta, once you get down into the real players in the apartment investing world, it's a small community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are people with great reputations, and there are a lot of people who are unknown as well.
Mm-hmm. My sense is in the real estate industry, there are a lot of key players that are high net worth individuals that really don't want their name out there.
That's true.
A lot of sports people, entertainment people, those that perhaps are wealthy individuals that are executives of, you know, what are the local firms, whether mm-hmm. that be having started up their own family-owned corporation or individual-owned corporation, or whether they're, mm-hmm. you know, one of the higher-level individuals from a large corporation, mm. there tends to be a desire for a lot of anonymity.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for liability protection. And But it's one of the wonderful things about our country is that property can be individually owned, and we have a variety of corporate structures that can be utilized depending upon current tax code.
Is that something that is very key to your decisions? Are there various different taxes in different jurisdictions that are relevant for you in the real estate industry?
You know, the interesting part that I use right now is the LLC, because the income and expenses can be directly reported on one's individual tax return, thereby not requiring a payment of a corporate tax prior to distribution of profits to the partners.
Each partner would essentially run that income through in the proportion of their ownership.
That's correct. They'd receive a K-1 form from a partnership federal return, but that federal return doesn't pay income tax. It just reports income to the partners.
Now, do you have employees and employee-related costs for the maintenance staff and management staff?
We sure do. I have my own management company, and our management company provides a direct cost. The on-site management and maintenance.
And typically in the real estate business, would that be set up as a separate legal entity?
It is.
Is there a reason for that? Is it legal or a risk perspective?
I do that for liability protection. I think number one is to treat everybody fairly and honestly, and number two, have lots of liability insurance, and then three, have the payroll company as a standalone firm. So the liability is separated from the physical asset.
When you refer to liability by housing these assets or employees in different corporations, does that reduce your risk and thereby help alleviate some of the cost burden of your insurance premium, or is it beyond that?
It also simplifies payroll. I have one simple payroll account for all of our staff. And so it just simplifies the accounting work as well.
Okay, so you essentially in the real estate business now have 2, 3, maybe 4 companies. Mm-hmm. You've got the houses or the properties in one. You've got the employee base in another. And then you have these various other elements of the business in that third, so that you've got the payrolling separate. Mm-hmm. So does that give you complexities and additional costs when it comes to doing your taxes? You've now got 3, 4 companies to manage.
I tell you, one of the exciting points in my career was when I hired my own bookkeeper.
Being a finance program, I think everyone listening will love to hear that.
And it does. And then dealing, I bring in an outside auditor as well, which has been a real learning curve back when I did that a few years ago.
Now, one of the key elements of business ownership as you grow, and I understand that you're quite sizable now, there's always that time period where the business owner has a dilemma in that they're big enough now such that the owner can no longer be the one to sign off on the checks. And the online banking account may need to have the controllership aspect of that hand to somebody else. How is that for you? Is that a hard decision to make, to have somebody else have access to your bank account? Or do you just plain and simple say, no, it's got to run through me?
You know, I run, my bookkeeper handles the payroll account, but all the other expenses I personally handle in terms of outgoing capital.
So you keep all the funds in separate bank accounts, as well as it's a separate legal entity, it's a separate payroll bank account.
It's a separate legal entity. And with online bill pay, it's so easy. So it doesn't really take that much time.
So really, you're the person that is managing those bank accounts as well.
That's correct. One day I'll hire an accounts payable clerk.
No, I hear you.
Right now, my property managers write work orders and approve expenses, and then I pay them. I review and pay.
Understand. So you can keep the accruals listing of knowing what's coming up for payment, but you've got the control of you actually signing off on the checks.
I actually manage the cash flow. And it's with the payroll company, it's fun because the payroll company gives my individual apartment complexes a bill once a month for payroll, which simplified that. And it's funny, I started in the beginning of my career, I self-performed everything. I had just a couple small rental units. I was working full-time as an engineer.
So you've had real estate for quite some time.
I have, and it was my friends told me I was crazy. My coworkers like, Richard, what are you doing? And I rented my home in Peachtree Corners and bought a 4-unit apartment building, 4 lovely townhomes, and moved into one of them. I wanted to be able to afford the mortgage if nobody was going to pay rent.
So you essentially took your family residence or your home, your single home, and bought four townhomes, lived in one of them, but you've got rental income from the other three.
The other three paid all my expenses and gave me an income, and I painted and did maintenance and repairs and leasing, and I grew that business. And I remember years ago, a decade ago, when I hired my first full-time maintenance man. It was great. I didn't have to use outside contractors. And then I can remember the point when I hired my first full-time manager. And it's fun. I look forward to the day when I hire my own CFO.
And look forward to the day when you hire your own CEO, right?
Yes.
When you can replace yourself.
Yes.
But yeah, let's talk a little bit about the aspect of the financing. We've talked about some aspects of the financing. Ongoing, do you find that banks and financial institutions are open to real estate? I mean, they've had a tumble turn, and a lot of them have taken a bad turn. Are they open to the dialogue with you in terms of helping you?
It's unfortunate that many institutions have such a large balance of poorly performing real estate loans that they're not willing to originate new credit. That all said and done, I think the secret to the real estate investor is to be well capitalized and have a proven financial history in their tax returns and their partnership returns. And from that perspective, it is easy for someone who's capitalized and has experience, the credit is widely available. And it's very attractive today. With the bad economy, we have low interest rate costs for capital, which works magic in real estate.
Sure it does. Sure it does. If you've got the access to that capital.
That's correct.
Are you finding that particular financial institutions, and I'm certainly not asking you to name names, but some are more open to the lending than the others?
That's correct. And unfortunately, many banks, particularly in Metro Atlanta, that were focused on real estate loans are not originating new debt because they have too much bad debt. Their portfolio is too weighted to real estate, and it's not a pleasant experience for them. But there are specific lenders, as well as national lenders and federal agencies, that have credit available.
But that's not a closed avenue right now. There is still lending.
I have friends that joke that if you need an umbrella, don't go to the bank to get a loan to borrow one. It's too late. And
that's interesting.
And it's very unfortunate. I'm watching some successful business operators who've operated with appearance of success through the years. They've come down and their property doesn't appraise, and they had too high a leverage on their commercial loan, whether it's a strip mall or an office building or an apartment complex, and it won't. Once the balloon is met, they can't refinance it in the present terms they've had. So we see properties being foreclosed today because the ownership entity is being told to come to the closing table with a couple $1 million in capital to refinance because of deteriorated financials on their properties, and that often results in foreclosure.
Have you acquired any foreclosed properties?
I have through my career, but can be very difficult with foreclosures because the property can be extremely neglected. You know, high vacancy and a lot of capital expenditures required. So it's not a quick turnaround to buy an apartment community that has gone through foreclosure. And I looked at one recently. The entire complex was vacant, and the copper wiring and plumbing had all been stolen together with the cabinets and the HVACs. And this was in a nice Gwinnett County community, relatively speaking, nice. And so that would be a very unpleasant job for the acquirer of that asset.
Sure. When you're getting down to a building, having the copper removed, that means they've destructed the walls and the floors.
Mm-hmm. And copper's expensive, wiring and plumbing, new HVAC systems. So it's very much a buyer beware. It takes a lot of due diligence. And I actually sit down and do a full engineering study and write down. I personally go through with my staff, with my experienced staff, and go through and identify repairs to be performed by each building and by each apartment, and they can sit down and financialize the cost of acquisition. And the result can be a property can look like it has an attractive price and go, wow, this is less than half the cost of construction. but you have to be aware of the capital costs once you take on the asset as well.
Now, in that regard, when you make these acquisitions, is insurance a significant part of your planning program and your strategy?
You know, property insurance is very important, and it's very important to have a quality insurer at a reasonable rate. And so property insurance costs really is pretty insignificant in terms of the overall operation of the community. Oftentimes, a greater expense is the utilities. And property tax can be very oppressive too, particularly since some properties obtain such a high value during the go-go years that the property tax may be 3 months' gross income, gross collected rent for an apartment complex, which is doesn't work.
That's quite substantial. Yeah. So what have you learned in terms of the investments that you, the real estate that you've held? Are there any, you know, words of wisdom that you might give? Or maybe you don't want to give them away.
Oh, no. I call it the school of hard knocks. And you end up getting a graduate degree in real estate. And it's when you buy an income property, it's like getting married. You've picked it with, in terms of real estate, you've picked the place where you're going to live and work. You know, this isn't something, it isn't like buying a stock on the stock market or a mutual fund that you can buy and forget about. The property actually takes supervision and maintenance and management. And it's the late night programs joke about how one can buy real estate with no credit and no money down. And there's a way that people have figured out how to do that. But if the owner doesn't have credit and capital, they're not going to be able to own the property, not going to be able to take care of the repairs or handle the vacancy. So all of this is, the capital needs can be very surprising for someone looking from the outside, you know, in terms of vacancy and maintenance and repairs. And one cannot always depend on the monthly cash flow to do things like replacing roofs or siding, digging up sewer lines, putting in all new water lines.
Yeah, you need the capital reserves for that. And do you separate the elements of reserves between the nature of what you're reserving for?
I keep a portfolio reserve balance. So I have a comprehension of the reserve requirements. But fortunately, I worked out with my lenders. I don't actually have to go through a physical reserve with the mortgage companies, which simplifies my life.
Yeah, simplifies your life and probably simplifies the relationship that you have with those lenders.
It does. It makes everybody happy.
It sounds as if the element of what you've put together from a structure in corporate is in main part for simplicity. The payroll costs in a separate company, there's an element of risk and risk aversion there, mitigation, but there's also an element of simplicity that it makes the management of the business a lot straightforward, efficient, and effective.
And that's correct. And another point I'd raise for real estate investment is important of not over-leveraging your business. And it's interest rates are very low right now, but they may not always be so. And I always plan personally for what I call a margin of safety. When one writes a business plan, you have to be able to prepare for the eventuality of perhaps another dip in the economy. And I think that was forgotten in the marketplace in this past decade. Everybody was always projecting continued future improvement. But when a business plan demands improvement in the general marketplace, if that's one's key for success, I call that speculation.
Sure.
And that's an opportunity to lose one's assets.
Sure. That's going to Vegas and rolling the dice, huh?
It is. So as a real estate investor, I tend to be very, very conservative. And I see that in other successful real estate investors as well, where we're not speculating on price of an asset. You know, but we're actually driving a business with known expenses and historical income. And that's one of the nice things about apartment investment as well, is everything's very predictable. You know, the public requires a place to live. We have a third of Americans are long-term renters. They're career renters. And with in the marketplace where I serve, that career renter, people will pay a premium for having a well-managed property where the on-site management is funded and will take care and serve their needs and provide clean, affordable housing.
And do you brand that under a particular name?
And actually, I don't. Each apartment community has its own LLC.
And its own branding thereby.
And its own branding and its own secrecy as well.
Sure, so. Absolutely. Because you may have an investor that invests in only one of those. So you probably have quite a complex structure of legal entities that you're managing.
Complex, or it's just a number of entities.
You are correct. Yes,
it's an interesting bookkeeping system.
Sure. And your CPA is your bookkeeper is going to be keeping hold of all of those.
Yes.
So let me ask you the question: how do you determine whether the investor or the potential investor that comes up is the right investor for you?
You know, it's someone I want there to be a sense of mutual respect, and everybody has to be able to work in a way where the the corporate environment is right. It's almost like when you take on a long-term investor, it's like bringing into an employee into a small family-run business. And you want there to be cooperation and respect there, and where everything can work in alignment to the best interests of all the parties. And so I think it's important to pick one's partners with that in mind, because it is a long-term relationship, and it is someone you want to enjoy speaking to in the future.
Sure, so. But very, I've heard from closely held businesses that very often an owner taking on new partners, the relationship is one that they say is tighter and more complex than a marriage, because at least a marriage you can get out of relatively straightforwardly. But a partner, very often you can't, because the business transactions still need to take place.
The business transactions take place, and you probably have a substantial mortgage as well. That mortgage has to be paid. And typically the general partner, if there's a guarantor for the loan, the general partner is the guarantor. So it's not only a limited partner may have at risk their original investment, the general partner has at risk their business enterprise.
Understand. Well, Richard, I hate to do this. I could talk for a long time in terms of the real estate industry, and we could dig a lot deeper. We're nearing the end of the show, but we have one last question that we ask all of our guests. And that is, what is your CFO tip of the month? From the world of real estate, what is your CFO tip of the month?
That's a great point. And I would encourage real estate investors or investors in general to, one, be very well capitalized. Don't risk your assets through speculation. And then number two, to value the opportunity they have for investment based upon the actual income that the investment will generate and that it has historically generated. So I'm very value-driven from an income perspective for an investment.
So looking at the cash flow again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a great tip. I'd like to formally thank you, Richard Sims, for being our guest today on the radio show. Would you like to give a shout-out for your corporation name or the general umbrella name that you serve?
I want to thank CS Investments.
CS Investments LLC. Wonderful. Well, we appreciate that. What I'd like to do is to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. And thanks also go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And last but not least, National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. Their website can be found at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.